So.
Oh, that's perfect.
That's a pretty general statement, I know, but
very general. Yes, yes, yes. I just want to welcome everybody to the House of the Risen Sun. This is Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and we're looking at, you know, how are we forgiving this dream? And every day it's a new challenge, and every day it's a new lesson. And I'm just finding myself really blessed. By everything, and it looks like the whole world, you know, if you had any notion, honestly, even people who do not know or study A Course in Miracles are waking up in the morning and saying, this can't possibly be real. This, what I'm seeing in this world cannot possibly be real, because it's crazy. You know, it's like everything just getting more and more accelerated into insanity. And, you know, it's gotta be, you know, that folks that, because it's real evident to me, you know, how could this actually be happening? This is obviously, just an elaborate ruse.
Truly. Well, should we continue, reading from Gary's book?
Yeah. And,
your book?
Mm-hmm. Let me go. It's so weird because both of my computers, Skype has got that little, oh, there, finally it's settled down, that little going around thing, which always makes me nervous because, you know, I think I'm getting kicked out or something, but it's just, I don't know how they ever got the going around in circles as being a good way to warn you that they're about to drop you, but. all right, here we go.
So I had us on page 20 of the introduction, which is actually a note from the author that's prior to the introduction, which is in the preface material, page XX, second paragraph from the bottom. Is that where you have your bookmark?
Well, you know what? I am logged into the wrong account, so let me just...
Okay. Well, while you're doing that, I could basically give a little overview and read the first paragraph.
And
how's that then?
This stuff is brilliant. A lot of people are really excited about this book, and I'm not doing anything like that. It's wanting me to do.
Okay. Well, how about if I just give a little overview then? Okay. Lynn and I have been reading for the last couple of weekends, on Saturdays, from The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, History of Mighty Companions is the subtitle, and that's the fourth book by Gary R. Renard, and his other three books are equally brilliant. This one's a bit more standalone, but it also relates beautifully to the other three books. And we have been reading the introductory material is from within a note from the author about A Course in Miracles. And we left off on page 20, which is XX in the preface material. And he begins, this is why A Course in Miracles is completely relevant to Jay and Buddha. And maybe I should back up a paragraph. How about I do that? Give the context. That's usually good. Okay. In fact, I think this is actually a good starting point. So I'll back up a paragraph that we read last week. He says, this seemingly separate existence is actually a dream. The teaching that the world and the universe are an illusion is thousands of years old, but the Course refines the teaching into the idea that this world is a dream that you will awaken from, and it's that awakening that is enlightenment. This is what Buddha meant when he said, I am awake. Those three words in quotes. Today, most spiritual students think that when Buddha said, quote, I am awake, unquote, he meant he felt amazingly alert and ready to manifest like hell. And I've heard Gary use that phrase a number of times in his talks, which is funny and appropriate because, you know, we're all so eager to fix the dream rather than to wake up from it. But, which is a lot of, you know, new agey stuff, if you will, spiritual buffet line, material is oriented toward, but nothing, not there's anything wrong with that, but it just doesn't really make us happy ultimately. Okay. And then he goes on, indeed, that's what passes for enlightenment in most of today's spirituality. But Buddha didn't mean he was more awake in the dream. He meant he had awakened from the dream. And that's not just a minor distinction. It's everything. Buddha realized that he was not the dreamer, the dream, but the dreamer. And that's a very, you know, another important distinction there. He was not actually in the dream at all. The dream was coming from him, and he was not an effect of it, but the cause of it. Okay, so now the next paragraph where he, a short paragraph where he continues. He says, that is why ACIM is completely relevant to J and Buddha, J being Jesus. And he refers to J as the symbol for Jesus or Yeshua of A Course in Miracles, as opposed to the historical figure, although this book really ties it together and clarifies a lot of the misconceptions, I think, that many people have. And then he continues, you cannot attain enlightenment without a total shift from being at the effect of the dream to being the dreamer, to being the cause. Then it becomes possible to awaken. And in order to do that, the ego, which is keeping you blocked in a dream state of separation, will have to go. So, and the way it goes is by recognizing that it never was. But that's not how we usually see it at first. It usually seems like this insurmountable obstacle that we have to fight and battle against and you know, transcend and yada yada. But ultimately, it's just a nothing. A few days ago, I was in a study group and Lynn Corona and Tim Wise, and they were mentioning a Muji video. So if you Google Muji and nothing, 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 you'll find this wonderful short video where Muji is basically reminding us that, in very much a line of the non-dual metaphysics of Course in Miracles, that our ego mind and everything that's projected from it is nothing. Nothing, nothing. And he repeats that word a number of times. But you can tell from both his, you know, genuinely emphatic words as well as, you know, the sense of humor behind it that, you know, there really is nothing, as the Beatles would say, to get hung about here. You know, there's nothing that really need, give us grief, because if we made up a dream, how could a dream be anything but nothing? So anyway.
Exactly. And it makes so much sense. And so, you know, people, when they read that, do not compute. It does not compute. Nothing just doesn't compute. And so, you know, how can we come to understand what he really means when he says it's nothing? You know, that I think that's one of the biggest hurdles that people, they have no conception of these things. It nothing to them means dead, empty, but it all is relational to their experience. And what people have not experienced is nothing. They don't know what that means. And so, you know, this is why it's so hard to come up with that, you know, to say that this world is nothing. The ego is nothing. It makes no sense. And you really have to, your mind has to really, really, really shift in order for that to be able to be understood. I don't know, you know.
Well, I was just going to say that the beauty of A Course in Miracles is that it doesn't just demolish the nothingness of the ego, which a lot of Eastern mystical traditions do, which is important in itself, but it's not the whole thing. And that's why I think, as this book goes into some detail about how, you know, Buddha, in this story, who shared six lifetimes with Jesus, as the account continues, had to discover that you can't just denounce the ego. You also have to accept the Holy Spirit, which is the awareness that we took with us into the dream as dreamers. That the reality there is a reality to our capitalist self that we all share, and it's completely inclusive. That is what we need to phase in as we phase out our identification with the ego. And if you kind of imagine the ego ramping down as an identity while, you know, drawing a little graph in your mind of ramping up is our identification with our real self, which is a completely shared self. And it can't leave anyone or anything out because it's all inclusive. This is a purely non-dual teaching. And so if we leave any part of what of course calls the sonship out, which is really just a symbol for the fact that, you know, all of creation is part of this one perfect oneness, and every seeming part, including all the seeming selves that think they're dreaming, the dreamers, are the creations of this oneness. And so metaphorically, we're the sons or daughters of God. And so there's no gender bias intrinsic in the course. It's just the convention of the Shakespearean language. By the way. But that's the beauty of the course, is that basically while you're watching the nothingness of the ego for what it is, and seeing, you know, this devastating illusion is really just silly. The reality that is basically reflected in our relationships in the world with everyone and everything, as we forgive ourselves for the grievances and forgive ourselves for having believed that we could possibly project something that is intrinsically our capital S self outside ourselves, we find our relationships heal to everyone and everything. And that happy identity is something over time we gladly exchange for the lowercase I identity of ego's nothingness, because the real identity that we all share is everything. And we don't really have a grasp on that starting out. And that's why in the early phases of the course, I think it's so important, and why Teacher's Manual emphasizes the development of trust and goes into that in great detail, that we have to trust that there is an awareness and a true capital identity that we all have, that we will awaken to, that we've just dreamt that there's this, you know, imposter identity that has, you know, so completely seduced and entranced our mind that there's a real identity that we can awaken to. So anyway,
exactly. And the thing that I think is probably for me the most helpful is that I really don't have to see nothing. I really don't have to know that the world is not real. What I really have to do is join with my brother, see him as the Christ, forgive every situation that comes up, looking at it and saying, you know, recognizing this can't really be, this is, you know, not true, you know, and be able to actually forgive, because God would never have made this happen. This is not part of God's will. Therefore, it is not happening. When you start really looking at things this way, and the joining with the brother and the connecting with the Christ in the brother, you recognize the Christ in your own self, and all the rest of that just disappears. You know, that's what, you know, the disappearance of the universe is all about. You know, when you do the forgiveness and join with your brother, know your brother as a Christ, know yourself as the Christ, then the universe as you know it now no longer exists. And this was the experience of Jesus. Jesus' experience was not of a physical world like we experience a physical world. Once he came to a knowing of the truth about himself as the Christ, and the truth about everything as being manifestations of the Christ, when he began to see that, then he was no longer bound by time and space, because he no longer identified with the physical body of the Jesus character, and he identified only with the Christ. And that being the case, he was actually able to heal the sick and raise the dead, because he saw the truth of what they were and not that they were broken or dead. He called to them and they called to him, and it was the Christ that healed. It wasn't Jesus the man. So, you know, I think that, you know, anything that gets us closer to recognizing that it's the Christ that is, you know, all we need to be looking for, that is what's going to help us. And what is going to help me is if you would read to me the first three words of the last paragraph you just read.
Oh, okay. The first three words of the last paragraph is "That is why," and the next followed by ACIM. And the one that we'll be reading next, this starts with "We can't awaken from this dream.
Okay, so I'm looking for a sentence that has the word enlightenment. I'm trying to search through my.
Okay.
Here to where we're at.
So let's see. Let me find a kind of a unique word. How about analogy?
That's the good one. Ooh,
and in the second sense. Okay, I know you're working on a Kindle version, right?
So right.
Yeah.
Analogy.
Okay. In fact, and then after that it says, let's say you have a 3-year-old daughter. So 3-year-old would be a good, fairly unique word.
All right, I've got analogy. So let me go.
Okay.
Yep. There we go.
Okay.
We got it.
All right.
Technology. All righty. Very good.
So if you want to read that next paragraph, it's a fairly long one.
All right. It's the one with the word analogy in it.
Yeah, with the one that starts with, we can't awaken from this dream.
All right. Very good. So we can't awaken from this dream without help that comes to us from outside of the dream, from outside of the system. An analogy I like to use is this. Let's say you have a 3-year-old daughter and she's in bed at night sleeping. You peek in on her and you can see she's having a bad dream. She's tossing and turning and has an unhappy look on her face. What do? You don't go over there and shake the hell out of her because that would make her even more afraid. So perhaps you intuitively sit on the side of the bed and whisper to her. You might softly say something like, hey, it's only a dream. You don't have to worry. What you're seeing is not true. In fact, you made it up. And then you forgot you made it up, but you're seeing this with your mind. This is the kind of conversation I have with my children when they're sleeping all the time. And when you think about it, what is she seeing that dream with? Her eyes are closed, and you continue whispering to her, saying things like, everything's all right. I'm here with you, and I'm going to take care of you. Then an interesting thing happens. Your daughter can start to actually hear your voice in her dream. The truth can be heard in the dream. The truth is not in the dream ever, but the truth can be heard in the dream. And if your daughter listens to the right voice instead of the voice that speaks for the reality of the dream, she starts to relax. Maybe she begins to think that this dream she thought was so important isn't that big a deal after all. Then when she's ready to wake up without being afraid, she wakes up, and when she wakes up, she realizes she never left the bed. She was there the whole time. It's not that the bed wasn't there. It was just out of her awareness. I like that. That's a really good analogy.
Isn't that well spoken? Yes. I particularly like the way he phrased all that. Yeah. Because, it really is just a dream, and we've forgotten that we're dreaming. And if we can just remember, as the Course says, it generalizes, all your time is spent in dreaming. And so if that's the case, then we just have to extrapolate, what Freud said, and Ken Wapnick pointed out brilliantly, that Freud rightly, noted that the ego is insane, and in order to get in touch with that, we have to look at the unconscious mind, which Freud called the royal road to the unconscious. But a couple of things that Freud didn't catch that Ken points out is that the ego is insane, and it's a lot of dark stuff, but it's not real because there is a reality beyond that, which Freud, apparently didn't grasp. And all of our time is spent in dreaming, and if we could apply, the analytic techniques, not in a clinical way necessarily, but just to be a passive observer, and watch without condemnation, most importantly, what's going on in our daytime dreams that we call waking life, and if we can just look at that with our inner kindness teacher, then we have the raw material of our unconscious mind fed back to us. Because nothing is outside our mind, we can see the contents of our unconscious mind projected in all the things that make up our everyday lives. Everything, as Gary and his teachers say, everything, whatever's in front of your face on a given day, that's your forgiveness classroom. And so if we can just look moment to moment at what seems to be something that it represents this, even the most minor slight upset, and realize that is our perfect forgiveness classroom, and we can see that that's handcrafted, specially delivered, mathematically precise, perfectly tailored to our awareness so that we can, you know, make the fastest possible progress toward gently awakening from the dream. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool. And it's so practical when you can actually divorce your emotion from it, as in believing that you're guilty because you're having these thoughts or these things are happening to you. And, you know, what happens in my case, I just tend to start feeling like I'm really responsible for all the bad things that are happening, and I get diverted into this whole pity party guilt trip thing. And instead of looking and saying, oh my God, look at what that's pointing out to me about my own thinking, which is really all it's for. You know, by the time I get to the point where I'm saying, oh wow, it was my own thinking, and it reminds me of, do you ever watch a show called The Good Place?
I think you mentioned that before. I haven't seen it though.
Okay. Yeah, well then I won't go into it, but just as there's a character that, you know, at some point in this whole thing says, holy smokes, this is what's really happening. And no matter what happens, that character will always come to the point where they realize, oh, this is what's really happening. And once they realize what's really happening, it shifts everything. Mm-hmm. And that's really what happens. You know, once we realize what's really happening, because, like I said, it seems like everything is more and more and more absurd. Every day there's, you know, if you just flip on the news, you're just going to be bowled over by, you know, I mean, not, of course, the political situation here in this country is insane. You know, it's insane everywhere in the world. And, you know, there's like hordes of, you know, people suffering. You know, I saw a thing, and you've probably seen it, about slave trade, that, you know, people being auctioned off, you know, in slavery in parts of the world that, you know, in a world where we think, oh, that's been abolished and that's not happening, you know, you see it's not only is it happening, it's, you know, it's like business as usual. When we begin to see how absurd, you know, the things that we think we solved, the situations we think that somehow or the other we were able to shift and change so that there's no more, you know, bad things going on in the world, you know, and we've just been fooling ourselves. You know, when you begin to see how often you fool yourself with believing certain things are happening or not happening, and recognizing, you know, everything that we believe is a lie. Everything we see is a lie. Nothing in this world is true. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, when you begin to see how absurd things are, and they keep going on and on and on, and there's, you know, you look back thousands of years of history that, you know, it's the same thing over and over and over, and when will we ever learn? We won't, because these lessons keep coming back to us until we learn them. And, you know, as long as we're reluctant to take responsibility for the world that we see and continue to think that we're somehow a victim of it, we're not going to learn the lesson. And we're just going to keep coming back and coming back and coming back, or going through other parts of the dream. It's not like we reincarnate, like, you know, it's just we move into a shift to another story in the book. But we're going to keep doing that until we realize all these stories are the same. It's what I call the romance novels. You know, it's all the same, every single one of them, plot, story, everything. Just character names have been changed, and, you know, maybe some scenery has been changed. But, you know, until we get that, we continue to remain victim of the world, and we continue to buy into the dream. Yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah, as you're saying that, I was thinking, particularly the last part, I was thinking, boy, both my mother and my wife really like Hallmark movies from time to time. And there's nothing wrong with those. And there's nothing, just as there's nothing wrong with wanting to make this world, you know, a better, kinder, more humane, gentler, more loving, healed place. You know, that intention, that impulse, there's absolutely nothing wrong with. But it's ultimately misguided in the sense that if we really want to truly be effective, we have to go to the source of the problem rather than putting a band-aid on the effect and go to the cause, which is in the mind. And it's always about the choice in the mind of which thought system or which teacher. And this, you know, that's, it sounds like a broken record to say that, but we're so invested in it that the momentum and the inertia in our ego and our investment in the ego mind, which is what that really is all about, is so immense that it takes a lot of repetition, which is why I think Gary's books are brilliant, because they, and of course Miracles itself, of course Miracles, because it does repeat from so many different angles until we come around and, you know, looking like the six blind men and the elephant, we eventually realize it's all the same thing. You know, one guy grabs a tail and says it's like a rope, and one guy grabs the elephant's ear and says, oh, it's flat and large and very flexible. And another one grabs the tusk and says, no, it's very hard and elongated, and they're all right, but they're all partially right. But it's really until we, you know, realize that you were just seeing a piece of a distortion, that, you know, we don't get the whole picture here, that we have to look at the source of the mind to see the big picture. And the big picture really, I think, is that we're dreaming. and there's nothing wrong with the dream or the impulse to want to make the dream better. But ultimately, I think we realize that the idea of, as Ken Wapnick says, you know, when you realize you're in the desert, the thing to do is to leave the desert. And we don't do it physically, we do it mentally. And that's another important, you know, caveat there, I think.
Exactly. And we can do that every day with everything. That's what's so cool. So.
Shall I read the next paragraph?
Yes, go on and read the next one.
Okay. Continuing from, this is page 21 in the Roman numeral numbered pages in Gary Renard's fourth book, middle of the page, he says, and when we woke up this morning from the dreams we were having in bed last night, all we awakened to was a different form of dreaming. A Course in Miracles says, you are at home in God, dreaming of exile, but perfectly capable of awakening to reality. And into this dream, which is not reality, the Holy Spirit is whispering the same kinds of things to us that we might whisper to a three-year-old who's having a bad dream in bed at night. So you see, there's three-year-old is twice in the text here. Okay, the Holy Spirit is saying to us right now, hey, it's only a dream. You don't have to worry. What you're seeing is not true. In fact, you made it up, and then you forgot you made it up. But you're seeing this with your mind. The Course tells us we are, quote, reviewing mentally what has gone by, unquote. In addition, it makes the uncompromising statement, quote, all your time is spent in dreaming, unquote. I like how in these two paragraphs he starts with the metaphor, and then he shows, you know, point by point how each of those metaphoric symbols relate to the bigger dream that is, you know, the one that is the umbrella, if you will, dream, I guess, maybe, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But it's, you know, the nighttime dreams are just a subset. It's a dream within a dream. You know, Edgar Allan Poe said, everything we, and I'm paraphrasing this slightly, because I like it, the meter has it rhymes, says, everything we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. Yeah, and I think it actually is all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. But, you know, I think that's kind of a cool quote.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Very astute also.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so these frightful dreams, you know, a Poe-ish, if you will, you know, nightmarish reality, is just a dream. And that's part of the dualistic system that the ego has, is it occasionally will, you know, present us with, you know, a few dazzling, you know, spring flowers in the desert after a rain, but they don't last very long, and they're pretty ephemeral. They're they may blanket a few stretches of the sand for a while, but you know, it doesn't really completely satisfy us because it's not eternal. And as the Course says, how can time come to circumvent eternity? You know, it can't. But we believed that it can, and so we grasp and grope for the with a pun wordplay intended for the current news stories lately, at trying to find something in the world that's going to make us happy, you know, and but there's nothing here that's going to really truly make us happy. We want something that's eternal and that's permanent, that doesn't come and go, that isn't subject to doubt and decay and death and other dastardly deeds and thing diversions.
and think about it. I don't know about you. I don't know how your mind works, and I recognize that.
I don't either.
Everybody's mind works differently. I find, I'm thinking that people are thinking the same things I am, but they really aren't, for the most part. But something that I have always noticed is that any time I get something good or something I really like or something I'm really happy about, almost immediately upon receiving this whatever, the next thought is, what will I do when it's gone? How will I feel when I no longer have this? Mm-hmm. This thing is so wonderful, but it's not going to be the same. You start worrying. You know, I noticed this with animals. I love animals, and I don't like to have a pet. A lot of everybody has pets. My daughter has like 5 cats and lives here in the house. So of course I have all these cats around me and a dog. Immediately when a new animal comes along, the first thought I think is, someday this animal, I will love this animal. It will love me. We will have a great relationship, and then it will get sick and old and it will die. And, that happened. It's happened my whole life. Every pet I've ever had has gotten sick and old and died. And, got hit by a snowplow or something. But in general, love means loss in this world. Doesn't matter what it is. You like something, eventually you will lose it. And so it's like all joy is tinged with disappointment. Every thought of love is filled with also thoughts of loss. And so there's nothing in this world that can truly make me happy.
I think go ahead.
Okay. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that's why Jesus in his Course here says, I'm going to paraphrase probably, but, it's so completely insane to think that we can lose something that we love. And that's why, the ego's definition of love is just nuts, because it's predicated on the idea that there's something that in a dream ephemeral world that can make us happy that appears to be outside of ourselves. I mean, how can anything that's outside truly make us happy? How can anything that's ephemeral, that comes and goes, make us happy? What I find helpful in those times of loss, when people appear to have passed from our lives, and obviously we probably all have had plenty of examples of that. Yeah, there's a couple of friends who very recently had family members pass, and what comes to mind is, if I can remember that the spirit that I appreciate is within me, that awareness has never gone anywhere. It never was born, and it can never die. And if I can remember that, not only does it help the grieving, and it's not that there's anything wrong with the grieving, but I think if I can remember to identify with what never changes, what we all eternally share, and feel the smile and feel the hug, if you will, of that, that it can be reflected in this world, as it says, the reality is never in the world, but it can be heard here. It can be reflected here. We can hear the voice in the dream, as Gary is saying in this writing. We can get, glimpses or expressions of. It's not the thing itself. It's just a shadow at best of the greater reality that is what's worth aiming for and, you know, returning to, truly awakening back to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And just trying to remember that, no matter what seems to be happening, it's not denial. A lot of people say, well, you know, you're just doing denial. No, denial is not remembering the truth. See, that this is what the Course, and this is what Gary, this is what everyone is trying to remind us of. Remembering the truth is not denial. Mm-hmm. So, it's actually affirmation of what's real.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not to say that you know, if you feel a grief over the loss of a loved one, or you know, it could be a vehicle or a home or a situation or you know, a geography, or a, you know, it could be all kinds of things that change and come and go, that seem to enter our lives and seem to exit. You know, like Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and the players have their entrances and their exits. You know, but those things that come and go are just the props in a dream that we made up. And you know, while we're watching those thoughts and feelings and emotions come and go, if we can remember that the reality has never left our minds, the reality of that's behind those, which is really getting us back to the Creator, back to the awareness that we took with us into the dream that reminds us of that Creator that we all share, then there's no instability and no doubt and no uncertainty and no mutability, no changeability in that awareness, because that, by definition, is what is eternal, and that's the true nature, the true essence of what we are.
Exactly. Well, and when we're talking about grief and talking about mourning for what passed, for the most part, well, and for all part, in fact, is trying to rebring the past into the now, and so when you think about the circumstance, oh, you know, my mother died, and then you're thinking, oh, I'm sad my mother's gone. Well, you know, my mother died years ago, and anytime I bring it up and I start feeling sad about it, like it just happened now, I'm actually bringing the past into the now, and then I'm saying how I'll never get over this. People actually say these words, I will never get over this.
Sure, that's very commonly said.
Yeah, so you're projecting into the future how you're going to be based on how you are feeling now, and you're feeling that now because you've dredged up something from the past that has reactivated actually a physical reaction in the body that occurs when grief or upset, you know, things happen. You know, you get all these chemicals going in your body, and you can go for years and never have those chemicals reacting again. And then you can dredge up a memory of the past, and boom, there they are again, just like it's just happening now. And the pain is now. You're experiencing it now, and then you're projecting into the future that you're going to continue to experience it. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It just goes on and on and on and on and on, as long as we continue to live in any time other than this moment.
Right. And also, if we, you know, as you point out very eloquently, if we keep dragging the past into the present where it doesn't belong, because the past never existed, the future never will exist, but as A Course in Miracles tells us, everything is in the dream world is already over. You know, it was over long ago, which is kind of a boggling concept that the conversation we're having right now, the air pressure moving in and out of eardrums, might be listening to this, the surroundings of the people that might be listening to this, including both of us, expanding to include the so-called physical universe, was over a long time ago. But that is just something that's so staggering. We can't really grok it very well. So we just have to kind of work with where we think we are, which is, you know, we think that we're in this world and we have all these things to deal with. So if we can just deal with the things that come up and realize, okay, this is a projection of my unconscious mind that I can either use to keep me in prison or I can use to set me free by seeing it as a classroom for forgiveness, by seeing that A, it's from my mind and not from some other thing or some other person or situation. And B, it's, because it's from my mind and because it's, you know, most importantly, not real, because anything that can come and go can't possibly be reality if reality doesn't change, then we can afford to gently dismiss that as something that is impacting our true identity. And if over time our true identity then becomes more important to us, and we, as we, you know, remember that and drop the ego's identity, which is has been over a long time ago. So.
Exactly. And wow, what a great point. And thank you for reminding us of that, because so often you get carried away in life and thinking that you have some impact. You're going to be able to change the future. You're going to be able to make sure that doesn't happen again. All that kind of stuff. And you're not in charge of the dream. It is a dream. It is, you know, Kumarji in oneness. You know, when he asked, you know, why do things happen the way they do in this world? And everybody had all these ideas. And he said, because it's nature. This is what is happening to you is just a part of nature. It has nothing to do with your reality. And I think nature is as good as a name as the dream. It, because you look at nature, you know, who's planning it? Who's saying, you know, birds lay eggs and live in trees and fly around, and trees grow from the root to the top instead of upside down. And, you know, nature is going along its own way without any interference or any planning on our part. And we think somehow or the other, we are in control of our lives and our future. What we're doing is just a part of nature, too. And this conversation, yes, took place long ago. You know, did I recognize that before? No. Do I recognize that now? To an extent. but there will be a time when I will know that. And I understand that, you know, the time has already been appointed, as Jesus tells us, when we will know. So, you know, what we can do now really is be patient. Be loving, be forgiving, work on our own thinking, and just recognize that everything is going according to plan.
Mm-hmm. And the working on our own thinking can take one of two forms. It can be very challenging work if we try to do it from the ego thought system, which is basically asking a dream figure to disidentify with itself. Mm-hmm. a tough task, no matter how you look at it. Or we can recognize that our real identity has to do with how we all are one being, one thing, one awareness. And I think we rediscover that through our relationships with everyone and everything, and seeing that we're all truly completely innocent, not partially innocent or partially forgiven, if you will, or partially you know, okay. But the reality is that, you know, we're all together in truth and never left that oneness. So if we can remember to see that in each other and see that in ourselves, that is, you know, a whole different classroom than finding fault and grievances and seeing that, you know, from that crazy perspective, that there's something that needs to be fixed in the dream. You know, it doesn't mean we don't do things within that script of the world. It just means that we don't take it quite so seriously. You want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And yeah, we learn to live in joy.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Really what happens is our lives change from fear to joy.
And the paragraph you're about to read ends with one of my favorite quotes.
Okay, well, let's get there then. Let's see, does it start with the reason?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, the reason this dream seems so much more real than the dreams we have in bed at night is because of levels. There are no levels in heaven where there is only perfect oneness and no differences, but ego's world is full of levels and differences. This is a trick to make us, change the page, believe that because this dream seems so much more real than the ones at night, then it must be reality. Yet even many physicists of today will tell you the universe has to be an illusion. It can't possibly be here. Some are even becoming convinced that this is all a simulation. But whatever you want to call it, the fact is that you dream that you're born, you dream that you have this strange life, you dream that you die, you dream that you have this in-between period, you dream that you're born again, and it goes on and on and on. Our lifetimes are like serial dreams that occur one after the other, so we are always in an unreal state. The form of the dreams appears to change, but the content is always the same. Separation. The Course teaches us that this is an unreal state, and in a state of unreality and confusion, there is always an underlying anxiety, whether conscious or not. Yet if we have the willingness to listen to the right voice that speaks for the reality of spirit, instead of the ego voice that speaks for the reality of the dream, we start to relax. Maybe we'll begin to realize that all these things we thought were so important in the dream weren't such a big deal after all. Perhaps there is a greater reality that is just beyond the dream and yet everywhere. It's not that it's not there. Excuse me. It's simply out of our awareness. This is why the Course talks about removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. Your natural inheritance is nothing less than the kingdom of heaven. And you don't have to earn it. It was given to you as a present by God. You don't have to earn a present, but you do have to awaken to it if you think you are here. I love the question the Course asks us. How else can you find joy in a joyless place except by realizing that you are not there? Wow.
Isn't that a great one? Yeah, there was actually a whole workshop given by the folks in Temecula, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, recently, a few months ago, with that theme, and an excellent workshop. And there's two more, by the way, if anybody's interested. They're actually shifting their focus a bit, but they're going to do two more streaming video workshops. And I've attended quite all the ones I've been able to, and they've all been excellent. You can go to facim.org and register either to, if you happen to live in Southern California, to attend in person, or you could watch them online for a very reasonable amount for, you know, these all-day workshops that are just super excellent and very much continue in the same spirit and awareness is what Ken Wapnick there taught for many years. So anyway, quick plug for the folks at facim.org, Foundation for A Course in Miracles.
And, well, good. So this sounds like that Rihanna song, "We Found Love in a Hopeless Place." That's what this is.
Yeah. Yeah, we keep thinking that there's something in the world that's going to do it for us, you know, which is the metaphor I use frequently is we put our dream repair technician hat on and think that, you know, well, there's something in the world that's going to do it for us. And, you know, again, you know, knock yourself out if you think that there is, but eventually, you know, and I think that's why there's such, you know, the infinite patience of the Course is that, you know, we're eventually going to figure out that there really isn't anything here. I mean, it's kind of like, when you move out of one house into another, eventually you come for that last load of stuff and in the back bedroom of somewhere or sort of closet or something, and you realize there's nothing left here for me, you know. And I think that, you know, we're sort of moving out of the ego's home into the Holy Spirit's home over a period of, you know, probably quite a few lifetimes, you know. And so, you know, we don't really see that transition, but I think in the cosmic scheme of things, we're gradually transferring our identity from trying to make a dream that, you know, work, this, as Ken Wapnick points out, the maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. And eventually we see, because it's a non-existent problem, that our approach to it has been a maladaptive solution to try to find joy in a joyless place. And then we realize, well, if that's not my reality, what am I hanging out here for? And it doesn't, to use the other analogy of leaving the desert, you know, when you realize that you're in the desert, it doesn't mean you physically move. It just means you move teachers. You switch the teacher you've been using, which is, you know, the teacher of separation. You realize that that's a dysfunctional, maladaptive solution, and instead you choose the teacher of shared interests and of trusting that there is a reality, and that we all have that voice. You know, just as Gary's writing suggests that, you know, we all have this little voice it's an infinite voice that whispers to us that, you know, you're just having a bad dream here. And, you know, nothing wrong with trying to fix the dream while you're in it, but really the only solution is to wake up from the dream.
Well, exactly. And so, you know, that's why I think it's, you know, for me, I had come to the point where I've just stopped pretty much all attempts to redecorate my dream world. It doesn't mean I'm not redecorating my house, but to switch and change things in my dream world. So, you know, I look at something that causes me pain. I look at that whole thing about the slave trade, all right, causes me to suffer. Excuse me. But, you know, why does it cause me to suffer when I know that it's not real and it's not true? Then I have to look at my own mind and think, what in me believes that it has been enslaved? Why do I believe that slavery is possible? You know, why am I thinking that these things are real and capable of causing actual effects? Because that really is the mistake, is believing that what we see is not only real, but also capable of causing real effect. So, you know, if I'm looking at my brother and projecting on him the idea or the thought of suffering, and I'm thinking, you know, this, you know, these poor people are in terrible, dire conditions, but that's everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we're all like one nanosecond from death here. I mean, anything can happen, you know.
Or actually, 1/10⁻¹. 44th and 33rd? One's the space constant, one's the time constant. The Planck space and time constants are 10⁻³ and -44, and sometimes they're, I think it's the time constant is 10⁻⁴ seconds. You know, we've actually been born and died 10⁴ times in the last second. You know, if modern physics is correct, we're just an enormously fast stroboscopic dream here, but we're making that real. You know, we're making that the real deal, because it's like a movie. You know, you don't see the individual frames flashing because it's happening so fast. We think that this pulsing, throbbing, illusory dream is the real deal because our minds are so powerful, and because our minds are powerful, we have the ability to convince ourselves of something that's totally outrageous but incredibly convincing. And here it is. I mean, you know, the so-called reality that we call space-time and everything in it.
Right, exactly. And time is what makes that possible. The concept of time is what makes that possible, because if we didn't have the concept of time, we would be seeing each individual frame as an individual frame. Mm-hmm. And we would see that it's all just pictures.
Right.
But because of the concept of time, we see it as a continuum. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you didn't have time involved, and it is time and space, as Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud explained to me one night in a dream, they are the same thing, and they're it's one thing that has been pulled apart.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we are one thing that has been pulled apart.
In a
dream, yeah. Yeah, so it's only by that separation of the one thing into two separate components that we're able to project this illusion and believe that what we see is what's really happening. But as you say, it is stroboscopic. It is like appearing and disappearing, faster than our mind, this ego mind can suss, and so we don't see it that way. Strangely enough, I'm writing a book about all these different things that have happened to me in my life, and I have a condition called oscillopsia, which is
easy for you to say.
Because my vestibular system was destroyed from having a antibiotics. That
there's a lot of fancy words here, Lynn. I want to have to grab a dictionary.
It's called bilateral vestibulopathy. Can't even say that. But what it is that the vestibular system is just gone.
And that's the system. It makes you dizzy just trying to pronounce those things, I think.
I know. It makes you dizzy because that's what gives you your sense of balance, right? So if you don't have a sense of balance, then you tend to fall down. And that is kind of my state. But the other part of it is that that is what actually causes your eyes to be able to track. So when a person has oscillopsia, you can put on, they put on these like magnifying glasses so they can watch your eyes, and then they track, bring their finger back and forth and you track it, and your eye actually stops. It is absolutely like a stroboscope. It stops and starts and stops and starts and stops and starts and stops and starts. That's how my vision is. That's how I perceive motion now, because of that condition, which
so
also
herky-jerky kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It also means that when my head is moving, I can't focus on anything. So it's a really weird condition. But like if I'm walking down a hallway and you walk up towards me, I won't be able to recognize your face until I stop moving. I have to stop moving my head to be able to focus. So it's real weird. But I think that I was given that actually as an illustration of how flawed our actual vision of the illusion is, and how we are being tricked by it. So I've gotten a lot of physical conditions. I think that were here to show me, even losing my balance, really taught me something about my concept of reality in this world.
Yeah. Well, how could a world where there's seemingly a person that represents the self, and then the rest of the universe, which is a whole, just in terms of the whole space-time continuum, seems to be a whole lot more than the body that this little self occupies. That seems pretty out of balance. Like, I mean, how could you have anything more out of balance than that? You know, I mean,
exactly. That's very, very true. That's very, very true. And the fact is that the reality that we experience is so limited. But when you think about, when you just stop and close your eyes and just sit for a moment and experience everything, experience the room around you, experience the walls behind you, experience the ceiling, experience the floor, just experience everything that you can experience and absorb in this, just this moment. And just spend a few moments just experiencing that, and then go back to thinking the way you normally do, and recognize how little of that experience are you aware of. You're only aware of the very finite experience that's right before your eyes, that's right in whatever it is that you're thinking about right now. That is the limitation of your experience, when in reality, if you were able to experience your whole experience, and this is just a dream experience, the richness of what is here would like you be just fulfilled every moment and never ever seeking for anything else, because every moment is full. But we don't do that. you know, we limit and concentrate and focus, and that limiting and concentrating and focus is what cuts us off from experiencing what we came here to experience. And in my opinion, may or may not be true, is part of the reason why we just keep coming back, because we never fully experienced what we ask for. And so we're always hungry for more. But if you actually truly experienced your life every moment, then you would never be hungry for anything else, because you would just be living in the moment and in the instant, and you wouldn't be planning for a future, and you wouldn't be mourning and grieving over a past. You would just be right here, right now. And I think that would shift everything. I mean, it shifts everything for me when I move into that space. Did I lose Bruce?
No, I'm here. I forgot to unmute myself. I think an important aspect of what you just shared is that that is part of the equation, I think, that the Holy Spirit provides us. But the remainder is that fully now as an ego doesn't cut it. But I think it's really the awareness that there is a teacher within us that helps us look at the ego's interpretations and distortions, and the narrowing down of perception, and certainly the narrowing down of our identity into the seemingly separate selves that appear to comprise this world. And that expanded inclusive awareness truly is in itself fulfilling, because it is the fulfillment of undoing everything that really either terrorizes us or makes us depressed and seemingly lonely. Another of the workshops from Temecula I just listened to the other day was the illusion of loneliness. You know, the idea that there can possibly be something outside of ourselves to miss or to feel apart from is nuts. But that's the world that the biological, physiological physics dream that we've made up appears to present to us. Not that we don't, take it at face value, but if we can remember at the same time, while we're letting that sensory data in and remembering that how much we distort it, that we're further, completely, messing with it by interpreting it with an ego thought system that reinforces the belief in separation, which is why I think, Jill Bolte Taylor's description of what it was like to lose the left hemisphere of her brain when she had a stroke, and even that experience, even though it certainly I wouldn't call it an enlightenment experience, it certainly had elements of recognizing that all the different names that we give things and all the boundaries that we assign with our interpretations of this is my hand holding a book that's next to another hand that's under a light that's attached to a desk and there's a headset and yada yada. I mean, I can look around, see all these things that appear to be separate, but it's all one thing. But that's not my normal perception. But anyway, do you want to? Let's see. Oh, I think it was my turn to read. How about if I read the next two paragraphs, okay, since the one after that's fairly short, and then you could read the next two after that, since the one after that one's fairly short. How's that sound?
Exactly. And you know what? This one actually, this next paragraph, I was going to talk about this, but then I saw it in the paragraph, so I said, well, we'll just read it. So,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. And we can certainly comment as we go along, which we like to do, which is why we still have 10 more pages after this to read in this note from the author after this one. Okay. But that's okay, because I think it's good, because, we personalize it, make it our own that way, right? Yeah. So Gary continues. This is on page 22 in the note from the author about A Course in Miracles, in Gary's Renard's fourth book. Okay, he continues. The Course is a very big teaching, not the little one portrayed by most of its teachers. The Holy Spirit is guiding us to awaken, not to be a better individual, but to be all of it, nothing less than one with God. And that doesn't happen overnight. We go through a process. Spirit is a higher life form than being a body. You have to be prepared for this higher life form, or else awakening would be too frightening. Just as a butterfly goes through a cocoon process, we do so too in order to awaken to what we really are. Okay, Christ says what, not necessarily who, right? What facilitates that metamorphosis is the Holy Spirit's teaching of a certain kind of forgiveness. The Course tells us, quote, forgiveness is the central theme that runs throughout salvation, holding all of its parts in meaningful relationships. The course it runs, directed, and its outcome sure. The end of quote. And then Gary's additional comment here says, there are three basic steps that make up the Holy Spirit's kind of forgiveness. Determined practice of them will eventually result in what the Course calls vision, and it will inevitably lead to your awakening from the dream of duality and opposites. I like how he spells it out. You know, it's basically, it's all about forgiveness, and if we practice that, eventually we get what the Course calls vision, and that, in turn, inevitably leads to awakening from the dream of duality and opposites. Pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. And it is really that simple, too. Although, as you know, it's simple, but it's hard. the simplicity of it is that it is just a decision that I make. And so forgiveness is, you know, just making a decision. Mm-hmm. The difficulty of it is that I don't want to make that decision for the most part.
Right.
And that's what really, for me, has been the trick, is looking at what I don't forgive. And in a lot of cases, it's because I have a personal investment in the outcome of a situation. And so instead of looking at it and saying, well, you know, this is impossible, you know, how could God have ever made something happen that would have, you know, caused, you know, nuclear war with Korea? You know, that is obviously not true. And therefore, my fear about it is unfounded, because even if there were nuclear war with Korea, it wouldn't affect what I am and what you are or anybody else is in any way at all. It is absolutely non-effect. So, you know, if you can look at these things and recognize that whatever happens is a part of the script, it was written long ago, there's no way that we can change it, nor should we even want to, because, you know, God help us if we could just continue to miscreate in this way. It would be it would be a major disaster if it was possible that we could just continue to make bad things happen. but recognizing that nothing really happened at all, it just was a story. We wrote it. We're watching it. We're reviewing it. I think Lesson 167 has a really good description of that. And when we're, if that's all we're doing, then any call to action or inaction on my part is just trying to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. Not going to make a difference. So, you know, forgiveness brings me to a point where I see that there is nothing to fear. There is no need to do anything. There's no need to worry about the outcome. There's only need to be joyful that when I forgive a situation, it causes the end of separation. When forgiveness is the end of separation. So, you know, the more I can look at these things and let them go, and, you know, let the Holy Spirit change my mind about them, you know, see how the reason maybe that I might be having these fears and letting them go, it causes a different way of seeing the world, and I can be at peace. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, how important forgiveness. I mean, it shifts everything.
It really does. And it doesn't mean that you suddenly stop wanting to change things in the world or have the, you know, the altruistic motivations and activities. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, for example, you mentioned the, you know, the slave trade in Northern Africa that's been in the news lately. You know, it's like, it doesn't mean that we wouldn't do whatever we can if we're in a position to, you know, to try to, quote, make a difference, unquote, in that so-called reality. You know, if you're involved in a political, committee or some kind of relief organization or some sort of an activism, you know, group or whatever that works for you, you know, why would you not continue to do those things? But you would do them with a different motivation. It's not like I'm going to be happy because I'm fixing the dream, or my ego will get, you know, a boost because I've done these wonderful things in the world. No, it's suddenly, you know, we realize that we may be called upon in the dream to do certain things, but our motivation is completely transformed because we're doing whatever we're doing as a result of listening to our inner kindness teacher and saying, the important thing for me to do here is to look at the contents of my mind, see where I'm holding any thoughts of condemnation or forgiveness, where I'm seeing any person or group of people or country or you know, religious affiliation or whatever as being less than or wrong or incomplete, because anything that appears to be separate from the all is just a misunderstanding on my part, and everyone is presenting me with a gift at every moment to see how I can heal my misunderstanding, and it brings all the onus always back to the decision making faculty in the mind, which is our only responsibility. And like the Course says, you know, our only responsibility in this world is to accept the atonement for ourselves, and the atonement being the willingness to forgive and looking with gentleness at our unwillingness to forgive and our enormous resistance to this, because it is really undoing the little less self that we have cherished and revered for countless millennia. So that, why would we want to give that up all of a sudden? Well, no, we're not likely to, but we can be gentle with ourselves as we notice the tendencies to want to fix the dream and see that as nothing, as Ken Wapnick says, nothing sinful, evil, or wicked. It's just something silly that, you know, about thinking that we need to fix the world, fix the dream, save the world. So, do you want to read the next couple of paragraphs?
Yes, I do. I just wanted to point out, too, that it's this belief in victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's a belief that, you know, there some people have more than others. Some people have less than others, obviously. Some people are victims. Some people are villains. These beliefs that this is possible and that these accusations of our brother, instead of seeing our brother as sinless, we're seeing our brother as sinful, and we're seeing our brother as being guilty of, you know, crimes against each other and crimes against us, you know, that's, you know, really the thing that for me, I have to just drop. If I know that it's a script and my brother's just acting out his part, then I can't blame him for being the best Donald Trump he could be, because that's how he is in the script. And why would I vilify him for that? You know, it's not my brother. It's a character. And, or, you know, these slaves, the people, the victims, the villains, all of that, if I could just stop seeing that as being their reality and recognizing that everyone came into this, this play to play one of the parts that's in the script. And it didn't change them. They didn't become that. They just are playing a part. And so for me to vilify them for being that is, you know, they're my victim now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've become the villain.
And they are images in my mind. You know, if ideas don't leave their source, then any person or thing that's upsetting me in this world is a perfect opportunity, a classroom opportunity moment, a teachable moment in my mind for looking at what I'm upset about. So if I'm, you know, metaphorically painting snidely whiplash villain mustaches on the villains in my dream world, then I've got to realize it's my inner facial hair that is bugging me, right? Just look in the mirror and realize, wait a minute, if I try to shave the mirror, it's not going to work. But if I get to the source of the problem, you know, if I hold that razor up to the glass, you know, it's probably not going to work very well for my daily shave, you know. But
daily shave. That's great. I love that. Thank you. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and read the next paragraph or two. We can begin to do what A Course in Miracles says is necessary for the salvation of the sonship, which you could take to mean everyone and everything that appears to exist. And that's a really good point also to make. The sonship is not just people. The sonship is the sum of all creation.
Uh-huh.
That's, I think, in one of the miracle principles it says that. So it's everything and everyone. Jade says, thus is all the thinking of the world reversed entirely. You do your part in salvation, which is your only responsibility in this entire mess we seem to find ourselves in. By practicing the unique form of forgiveness the Course teaches, you don't have to save the world. That's the Holy Spirit's job. Your job is to follow the Holy Spirit instead of having to be the boss. Now, if you own your own business, you don't have to tell anybody you're not the boss, but in your mind, you know who the real leader is. Many people think of Jesus as being the ultimate leader, but the truth is that he was the ultimate follower. In the Course, he says he just listened to one voice. This is the voice the Course wisely describes as the voice for God, the Holy Spirit, rather than as the voice of God. The Holy Spirit, rather than as the voice of God. God does not interact with the world because God is perfect oneness, and we should be happy God is not responsible for this world. If he was, he'd be just as crazy as we are. But because God is still perfect love, both the Bible and the Course say, that gives us a perfect home to go home to. In this dream, the Holy Spirit can and does see our illusions, but without believing in them. We learn to think like the Holy Spirit and thus awaken to Spirit by following the Holy Spirit's counsel to forgive. The first step in doing this requires discipline, the kind of discipline it takes to make a choice you are not used to making when the stuff hits the fan. So, yeah, and that's it. And he says the Holy Spirit can and does see our illusions, but I don't think the Holy Spirit actually sees the illusions. The Holy Spirit just sees that we're seeing it incorrectly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that it because we're so invested in, you know, our ego thought system, the inspiration that we call Holy Spirit or Jesus of A Course in Miracles is really the awareness that whatever specific thing we're looking at becomes the opportunity to undo the propaganda of the ego. And, you know, a few minutes ago, you mentioned four words about, nuclear war with Korea. I was just looking at those four words, and I was thinking, every word used by the ego becomes a propaganda mechanism. Because nuclear obviously refers to atoms, and atoms refer to the whole mechanism of space and time. And that's, again, left to the hands of the ego, becomes a tool for dividing. And not just fusion or fission, which appears to put separate things together and then take them apart, those same separate things. That there's one word that, you know, again, it is part of the dream of the duality. War certainly is, just out of the chute, a dualistic, idea. And it's basically without, if perfect oneness, was true, then anything less than that would have to be false. So, you know, the idea of war between different thoughts in your mind or different countries is equally unreal. And, you know, if we can just look at that without condemnation, that's part of our way out of the craziness. And then even the word with implies duality, because you have to have two things, you know, it has to be conscious to something with something else. and then certainly Korea, you know, as it becomes like any other specific thing, whether it's a nation or a person, you know, that becomes an object of specialness, whether it's a special love, special hate situation in a given moment. But just so I just happened to grab four words out of something you said and realized, okay, here's four seemingly random words that could be you know, part of ego's prison curriculum, its propaganda, or we could take the Holy Spirit's interpretation and say none of those exist, but the reality behind them is the eternal being that we all share, that is the truth that we all have and are. And so, you know, everything, every single word that we hear, every single thing that we see can become a classroom for returning to the oneness that we never left. So, should I read the next paragraph?
Absolutely.
Okay. As a personal example, let's, and he's talking about, you know, when the stuff hits the fan here, to recap the end of the last paragraph. As a personal example, let's imagine I'm driving down the freeway in Los Angeles where I live, and some guy cuts me off in traffic. We all know that cars bring out the best in men. And right at that moment, I have a conscious choice to make between one of two interpretations of what I'm seeing. I can do what most people do and think with the ego, which is to judge and perhaps even react, a big mistake, in parentheses. Maybe if I'm having a bad day and I'm particularly upset, I'll give the person who cut me off the finger. This can lead to all kinds of problems. What if that person has a gun? I could be dead. Not that there's anything wrong with being dead. And then he goes, after all, when your body appears to stop and die, your mind keeps right on going. So you're never really dead. But if you have things you still want to do here, there is another choice. So anyway, okay, I guess I'll read the next paragraph because it kind of ties into it. Instead of reacting with the ego, I can stop myself. That's not easy because it goes everything I've been taught for as long as I can remember. Stopping yourself is particularly difficult for men. Men have a problem called testosterone. If you push me, I'm going to push you back. It's built into the system. Men start wars. It seems that half of us don't know how to do anything constructive. Yet it is, and emphasis on the is, possible to make another choice. I can catch myself starting to think with the ego, and I can stop myself. That's the first step in true forgiveness. And that first step is the hardest. To take that first step on a consistent basis takes a firm decision to change and a determined effort to get into the habit of thinking with the Holy Spirit instead of the ego. So I don't think Gary's necessarily male bashing here. He's basically just ego bashing, male-oriented version of ego. But the female version of the ego is just as silly and ultimately releasable if we look at it again with gentleness and a sense of humor and realize it's part of an amazingly complex distortion we call duality, huh?
Well, yeah, and what it is, you know, what he's pointing out here, I think, with the comments about testosterone, is that it is a chemical reaction. That what happens is not, you know, because we are so invested in the body and have such a deep belief in the body as being are what we are, that and all memories, all thoughts, everything that comes into the mind that we are we grow up with from an infant, and actually from, you know, the womb, we have all of these chemicals, hormones, and you know, we have things like the amygdala, which is the organ that in the brain that causes fight or flight, that when it recognizes in fear, when fear comes into the mind, it causes all sorts of triggering for the body. Adrenaline starts rushing. All kinds of things happen, and it's all a chemical reaction. And this, when I was talking about the memories, when you start, when something happens to you in this life, it actually puts an imprint, a chemical imprint, on your body, on your in your brain, or you know, whatever, wherever it is, I don't know, but it continues to remember. And Earl Purdy talked about this at one of the conferences, where he was saying that you know, when you fell and skinned your knee when you were 8 years old, that scar, instead of, you know, being gone after 7 years when your body replaces itself, your body cells replace the scar over and over. They retain the memory, and that's what's happening in your entire body. Your entire body is remembering, you know, the pain of when I hurt my back, the pain of when I strained my muscle. It also is remembering the pain of when, you know, my dad hit me, or the pain of when I lost my, you know, best friend, or, you know, whatever. All those things are ingrained, are in the body as chemical reactions. And the brain, as, you know, Kurt Vonnegut very, very clearly pointed out to me in the book Breakfast of Champions years and years ago, everything that's happening in our brain, in our mind, is actually chemical reactions. And so, you know, the whole brain is, I mean, that's the way it works. It was an electrochemical reaction going on. So if you think your brain is responsible for generating your thoughts, you have no other excuse, really, than it's chemistry. But the fact that you can think beyond the chemistry, that you can look, you can move beyond the fear that comes into the mind, you can control the thinking, means that you're not a victim of the chemicals of the body. You're not a victim of testosterone. You don't have to react the way the body is telling you to react. And yep. That's where it makes a difference.
Right. Yeah, we're not the victim of the world we see, as of course Miracles would say. And as we, you know, continue with our forgiveness classroom and see that, you know, we really are not at the mercy of the world, you know, it can actually, it doesn't always, but it can have a biological, physiological shift, which is why, you know, over time, you know, the chemistry in the brain and elsewhere in the body can be more imbalanced if we're not stressing out about a dream world. In fact, even in the brain, over time, we could with the peace that comes from this curriculum, develop a shall we say a Mary Amygdalin.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. How's that?
So. Oh, that's terrible. But it
also ties into this, the rest of this book too, which is where Jesus and Buddha and Mary Magdalene all got it together in that lifetime and graduated, so to speak. And I think this is a fascinating read. So anyway, thank you again, Lynn, for sharing the last hour and a half with me. And we've been reading from The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, which is Gary Renard's fourth book. We got to page 24, it looks like, in the note from the author about A Course in Miracles. And I actually had a wonderful conversation with Gary and Cindy recently that I posted on acimblog.com. And also, if anybody's interested, I post books such as this on the ACIM blog website. And I get a little bit of affiliate commission if you happen to buy them from there, but it costs you the same. So I'm a little plug there for little support for what we're doing here. And I certainly appreciate all that you do, Lynn, and everybody at ACIM Gather. And what a great community we have. So anyway, have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you so much, Bruce. And I did post Bruce's website in the room. So please go and check it out. All right, and I'm going to hang up with you and turn the mic over to Devin and Barb, who are here. Thank you once again, Bruce Rawls, and
likewise.
See you.
Have a great week, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.